The grave lies in a region of the Black Forest called Eiffelheim. The region is heavily forested, and the soldiers refused to divulge the precise location, claiming that curious tourists would offend the grave's inhabitants. This suits nearby farmers who have a superstitious dread of the place. Monsignor Heinrich Lürm, a spokesperson for the Diocese of Freiburg im Breisgau, is concerned about the possible desecration of the cemetery by curiosity seekers, even though it is centuries old. "I suppose you can't stop these young fellows from believing what they want," he said. "Facts are much less exciting than fables." The Monsignor also downplayed the possible connection between the carving the soldiers have described and local folk tales of flying monsters called the Krinkle. "After a few hundred years of wind and rain," he said, "my own face would not look so good either. If modern American soldiers can make up stories about a carving, so can medieval German peasants." Sharon returned the clipping. "Well, there's your answer. Krinkle. They've got their own version of the Jersey Devil flying around." He gave her a look of pity.
"Sharon, this is the Black Forest. There are more demons, ghosts, and witches per square mile than anywhere on the face of the earth. These flying Krinkle of Eiffelheim sit on the shelf next to the Fellberg demon and the devil's pulpit and the witches' covens on the candle and Tannhauser's secret cave and all the rest. No, Schatzi. History happens because of material forces, not mystic beliefs. The abandonment caused the stories, not the other way around.
People don't wake up one morning and suddenly decide that the place they've lived in for four centuries is suddenly verboten. Das ist unseen."
"Well, the Black Death," Tom shrugged.
"But the death was a common cause that affected all the villages."
"Whatever the answer is, it has to explain not only why Eiffelheim was abandoned forever, but why only Eiffelheim was abandoned forever." He rubbed his eyes.
"The trouble is there's no data, nada, nichts, nichto, nix.
A few secondary sources, nothing at all contemporary to the events. The earliest reference I found was a theological treatise on meditation written three generations later. That's it there." He jabbed a finger at the folder. Sharon saw a scanned image of a Latin manuscript. Most of the page was occupied by an ornate capital D, supported by a trellis of vines twisted into a complex pattern that broke out here and there into leaves and berries, odd triangles, and other geometric figures. A vague feeling of déjà vu stole over her as she studied it. "Not very pretty," she said.
"Positively ugly," said Tom, "and the contents are worse.
It's called The Attainment of the Other World by Searching Within."
"Gott's Himmel!"
"I'm not kidding. Mystical drivel about a trinity of trinities and how God can be in all places at all times, including times and places we cannot know save by looking inside ourselves."
"But,"
Tom held his index finger up,
"the author credits the ideas to, and I quote, old Mason Sabke, whose father knew personally the last pastor at the place we call Eiffelheim."
Unquote. He crossed his arms. "How's that for first-hand data?" "What a curious way to phrase it, the place we call Eiffelheim." Sharon thought Tom was bragging as much as complaining, as if he had come to love the brick wall against which he was butting his head. Fair enough. Both were made of similar material. She was reminded of her mother's endless litanies of medical complaints. Not that her mother had enjoyed being sick, but she had taken not a little pride in the insurmountable nature of her illnesses. Sharon flipped idly through the printouts, wondering if there were some way to get Tom out of the apartment. He was spinning his wheels and making her life miserable. She handed him back the folder. "You need more data."
"Boje moi, Sharon. Ja nie durak.
Tell me something I don't know. I've looked and I've looked. Clio's chased down every reference to Eiffelheim in the entire net."
"Well, not everything's in the net," she snapped back.
"Aren't there musty old papers in archives and the back rooms of libraries that no one's ever read, let alone scanned?
I thought that's what you historians used to do before you got computers, root around in dusty shelves, blowing off cobwebs."
"Well," he said doubtfully.
Anything offline can be scanned in by request.
That's if you know the document exists. What about uncatalogued stuff?
Tom pursed his lips and looked at her. He nodded slowly. There were a few marginal items, he admitted. They didn't sound too promising at the time, but now... Well, like they say, cantabit vacuus coram latrone viator. He grinned at her. A penniless man sings before the robber, he explained. Like me, what can he lose? He leaned back in his chair and stared at the ceiling, pulling absently on his lower lip. Sharon smiled to herself. She knew that habit. Tom was okay. But he was like an old motorcycle. You had to kick hard to get him started. Later, after Tom had gone to the library, Sharon noticed Clio's screen still lit and sighed in exasperation. Why did Tom always go off and leave things running? Computers, electric lights, stereos, televisions. He left a trail of perking appliances behind him wherever he went. She crossed the room to turn his PC off, but paused with her finger over the trackpad while she stared at the empty cell. Eiffelheim. A sinister black hole surrounded by a constellation of living villages. Something horrible must have happened there once. Something so wicked that 7 centuries later people shunned it and had forgotten why. Abruptly, she cleared the machine. Don't be silly, she told herself. But that made her think of something Tom had said. And that made her wonder, what if... And nothing was ever the same again. 2. August 1348. At Primes, the commemoration of Sixtus II and his companions. Dietrich stepped from the church to find Oberhofwald in turmoil. Thatch roofs blown askew, shutters loose on their hinges, sheep milling and bleating in the pen by the meadow gate. Women shrieked or hugged crying children. Men milled about arguing and pointing. Lauren Schmidt stood in the doorway of his smithy, a hammer tight in his grip, eyes searching for an enemy to strike. Dietrich inhaled the dusty, urgent scent of smoke. From the portico's edge, whence he could spy the village's farther end, he saw thatch roofs ablaze. Farther off across the common meadow, black clouds churned and roiled above the great wood where the lustrous glow had been. Gregor Mauer, atop the carving table in his yard, shouted and pointed toward the mill pond. His sons, Gregor and Sevka, hurried past with buckets hanging from their thick arms. Theresia Gresh ran from house to house, sending people to the stream. Across the Oberide road, the portcullis of Manfred's castle rose with a clatter of chains, and a squad of armsmen dog-trotted down from Castle Hill. "It's the wrath of hell," said Joachim. Dietrich turned to see the younger man sagging against the doorpost. The eagle of St. John hovered in the wood beside him, beak and talons poised. Joachim's eyes were wide with fear and satisfaction. "It's the lightning," said Dietrich. "It has set some cottages on fire."
"Lightning? With no cloud in the sky? Where is your reason now?"
"Then it was that wind, toppling lamps and candles."
Dietrich, having no more patience, seized Joachim's arm and sent him stumbling down the hillside toward the village.
"Quickly," he said. "If the flames spread, the village burns."
Dietrich tied the skirts of his alb up to his knees and joined the throng heading toward the mill pond.
The Minorite had fallen halfway down the path.
"That fire is unnatural," he said,
as Dietrich passed. Then he turned and scrambled back toward the church. The gardener's huts, mean dwellings at best, were engulfed in flames, and folk had given up any thought of saving them. Max Schweitzer, the sergeant from the castle, organized bucket lines to pass water from the mill pond to the burning freeholder cottages. Dispossessed animals barked and snorted and ran in panic. One billy scampered toward the high road, chased by Nicol Langemann. Schweitzer held a wand in his right hand and pointed here or pointed there, directing the effort. "More buckets to Feldman's cottage, more buckets!" He slapped the wand against his leather hose and twisted Langemann by the shoulder to direct him back to the fires. Sippelbauer, straddling the roof beam of Ackermann's cottage, dropped an empty bucket, and Dietrich snatched it up. Dietrich made his way through the rushes and cattails that bordered the mill pond to the head of the bucket line, where he found Gregor and Lorenz knee-deep in the water, filling the buckets and handing them ashore. Gregor paused and wiped an arm across his brow, leaving a muddy streak. Dietrich handed him the empty bucket. The mason filled it and gave it back. Dietrich passed it on to the next man as the line made space for him. Gregor whispered softly as he drew another bucket through the water. This is no natural fire. Beside him, Lauren showed with a glance that he had heard, but the smith kept his peace. Others nearby also cast furtive glances in his direction. Sacred priest, anointed with holy oil, he would know the answers. Call down anathemas on the flames. Wave a shinbone of St. Catherine at them. For an instant, Dietrich was angry and longed for the cool, scholastic rationalism of Paris.